Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, we present new research on stroke prevention, Kawasaki disease, ICU infection strategies, and immune thrombocytopenia. We review hormone therapy and thrombotic risk. A case highlights an evolving diagnosis of severe fatigue and sleep disturbance. Perspectives explore nursing workforce policy, the role of nurse scientists in rebuilding trust, and the health consequences of environmental rollbacks. Asundexian for Secondary Stroke Prevention by Mukul Sharma from McMaster University, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and co-authors. Patients with non-cardioembolic ischemic stroke or transient ischemic attack, TIA, are at risk for recurrent stroke. Low factor 11 levels are associated with a reduced risk of ischemic stroke. This phase 3 trial evaluated whether the addition of the activated factor 11 inhibitor, Asundexian, to antiplatelet therapy would be superior to antiplatelet therapy alone for the secondary prevention of ischemic stroke. More than 12,000 patients were randomly assigned to receive Asundexian at a daily dose of 50 milligrams or placebo, in addition to planned dual or single antiplatelet therapy within 72 hours after the onset of a non-cardioembolic ischemic stroke or high-risk TIA. The median follow-up in this trial was 567 days. Among these patients, the incidence of ischemic stroke was lower in the Asundexian group than in the placebo group, 6.2% versus 8.4%. Asundexian also resulted in a lower risk of major cardiovascular events than placebo, without a higher risk of major bleeding. Marion Boulanger, from the Blood and Brain Institute at Caen, Normandy, Caen, France, writes in an editorial that Asundexian appears to be a very promising option for secondary prevention after non-cardioembolic ischemic stroke, or TIA. One minor concern is that no antidote to factor 11 inhibitors is currently available. Asundexian has a short half-life, 14 to 21 hours, but reversal strategies may still be necessary in specific situations, such as major bleeding or urgent surgery. Further studies of factor 11 inhibitors with longer follow-up, such as 5 or 10 years, are necessary to determine whether the net clinical benefit will be maintained over time. Randomized trial of adjunctive prednisolone for Kawasaki disease by Siwan Lin from the Children's Hospital of Fudan University, Shanghai, China, and co-authors. Kawasaki disease is an acute vasculitis that mainly affects children younger than 5 years of age and is a leading cause of acquired heart disease among children in developed countries. Coronary artery lesions are the most important complication, potentially causing aneurysms, occlusion, myocardial infarction, and even death. The current standard primary treatment for Kawasaki disease is high-dose intravenous immune globulin with aspirin. However, coronary artery lesions develop in approximately 10 to 20% of treated patients. In this trial in China, 3,208 participants with newly diagnosed Kawasaki disease were randomly assigned to receive prednisolone plus standard treatment or standard treatment alone. At 1 month, coronary artery lesions were detected in 16% of the participants receiving prednisolone plus standard treatment and in 13.8% of those receiving standard treatment alone. The overall incidence of adverse events did not differ significantly between the two groups. The addition of prednisolone to standard primary treatment for Kawasaki disease did not reduce the incidence of coronary artery lesions at 1 month after illness onset. In an editorial, Jane Burns from the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine, La Jolla, and Jane Neuberger from Boston Children's Hospital write that the work of Lin and co-authors aligns with medical society recommendations in the United States and Japan. Treatment with adjunctive glucocorticoids is not indicated in unselected patients with Kawasaki disease. The trial also suggests that although glucocorticoid therapy improves systemic inflammation, it remains imperfect at controlling inflammation in the coronary arterial wall. Because glucocorticoids can mask fever, which is often used as an indicator of disease activity, frequent echocardiographic surveillance is critical for patients receiving intensified regimens. Future research must move beyond systemic markers to identify the specific biologic factors driving tissue-level inflammation. Only a deeper understanding of mechanisms driving arterial inflammation in Kawasaki disease will allow for the development of targeted therapies for the children at highest risk for life-altering cardiovascular complications. Selective decontamination of the digestive tract during ventilation in the ICU by the Siddiqui investigators for the Australia and New Zealand Intensive Care Society Clinical Trials Group and the Canadian Critical Care Trials Group. Selective decontamination of the digestive tract is a preventive strategy involving the application of non-absorbable oral antibiotic agents to the oropharynx and stomach in combination with a short course of intravenous antibiotics. The principal aim of selective decontamination is to prevent the development of hospital-acquired lower respiratory tract infections resulting from an overgrowth of aerobic gram-negative bacteria and yeasts from the upper gastrointestinal tract in patients undergoing invasive mechanical ventilation. In an earlier analysis of data from Australia, selective decontamination of the digestive tract did not result in a lower incidence of in-hospital death than standard care. These authors report on the full international trial involving 20,000 patients in 26 ICUs in Australia and Canada. The ICUs were randomly assigned to use selective decontamination of the digestive tract or to continue standard care for two 12-month periods in critically ill patients undergoing mechanical ventilation. Patients in the selective decontamination group received specific oral and gastric antimicrobial interventions for the duration of ventilation and an intravenous antibiotic agent for the first 4 days after enrollment. Selective decontamination of the digestive tract did not result in a lower incidence of in-hospital death than standard care. Michael Klumpas from Harvard Medical School, Boston, writes that it is tempting to dismiss the Siddiqui trial results because no significant effect on mortality was observed, the point estimates differed in the results for Canada and Australia, and the duration of the trial was too short to determine the long-term effect of selective decontamination of the digestive tract on antibiotic resistance in the ICU. Similarly, some trials in a meta-analysis simultaneously published in NEJM Evidence were small, old, and less rigorous than the Siddiqui trial, and the results that were pooled across cluster randomized trials were inconsistent with those pooled across individually randomized trials. To dismiss the results of the Siddiqui trial and meta-analysis, however, would be to ignore the accumulating evidence that selective decontamination of the digestive tract confers benefits without clear harms. The net effect on mortality may still be uncertain, but fewer bloodstream infections and fewer resistant infections are concrete advantages, especially as U.S. hospitals prepare to publicly report hospital-onset bacteremia and fungemia rates and seek additional ways to lower sepsis-related mortality. In practice, however, most clinicians will want to see more trial data to confirm these benefits, particularly in their own specific locations and patient populations. Ianalumab plus L-trombopag in immune thrombocytopenia by Adam Kuker from the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and co-authors. Immune thrombocytopenia, ITP, is a rare autoimmune disease that is characterized by a low platelet count. ITP is associated with severe, potentially life-threatening bleeding events. The most common manifestations include mucocutaneous bleeding and fatigue. The goal of ITP treatment is to maintain an adequate platelet count to prevent bleeding while minimizing treatment-related toxic effects and optimizing quality of life. Glucocorticoids remain the standard first-line treatment, although most patients need subsequent therapy. This Phase 3 trial assessed the efficacy and safety of a short course of ianalumab, a monoclonal antibody targeting B cells, in combination with the oral thrombopoietin receptor agonist eltrombopag in 152 adult patients with primary ITP who had an insufficient response or a relapse after first-line glucocorticoid therapy. Ianalumab plus eltrombopag led to a longer time to treatment failure than placebo plus eltrombopag, with a stable platelet response at 6 months in a higher percentage of patients with ianalumab than with placebo. Sex hormone influences on venous thrombotic and cardiovascular risk. A review article by Leslie Skeith from the University of Calgary and Shannon Bates from McMaster University, Hamilton, both in Canada. Sex hormone therapy may increase the risk of venous thromboembolism and cardiovascular events. Sex hormone therapy includes sex hormone replacement for deficiencies, such as those associated with hypogonadism of menopause and andropause, contraceptive therapy, treatment of heavy menstrual bleeding, gender-affirming hormone therapy for transgender and gender-diverse persons, those with a gender identity that does not align with their recorded sex at birth, suppression of ovulation, oncologic hormone therapy, and assisted reproduction. This review examines the effects of hormone therapy in these contexts, including the effects of estrogen, progestogens, physiologic progesterone and synthetic progestins, and testosterone, on hemostasis, the vasculature, and the risk of thrombosis, and effects of hormone formulation, thrombophilias, previous thrombosis, and common clinical factors. Practical guidance is also provided on the prevention and treatment of hormone-associated venous thromboembolism, as well as on perioperative care of patients receiving sex hormone therapy. A 24-year-old man with depression, anhedonia, and fatigue. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Masood Kamali and colleagues. A 24-year-old man was evaluated in the outpatient psychiatry clinic because of depression, anhedonia, and severe fatigue. 4 months earlier, the patient had presented to the clinic for treatment of coexisting substance use disorder and mood disorder. During the current evaluation, the patient reported profound fatigue, non-restorative sleep, and frequent nightmares. Initially, the patient's symptoms were considered to be associated with psychiatric illness, a disrupted sleep-wake cycle, and medication effects, and it was anticipated that these issues would resolve as his psychiatric condition stabilized. However, over the course of subsequent visits, the clinical picture evolved. Despite improvement in the patient's mood and the fact that he remained abstinent from substance use, hypersomnolence persisted and became increasingly intrusive, manifesting as unintentional sleep episodes in low stimulation settings. The severity of his symptoms exceeded what would typically be expected with side effects of antidepressant medications, circadian irregularity, or residual depressive symptoms. The patient was referred to a sleep medicine specialist, and narcolepsy type 1 was diagnosed. This central disorder of hypersomnolence is characterized by cataplexy, or by very low levels of orexin A in CSF obtained by lumbar puncture. Narcolepsy type 1 is often undiagnosed or misdiagnosed, with a mean interval between symptom onset and diagnosis of approximately 8 to 10 years. Using data to inform decision-making. Borrowing Limits for Graduate Nursing Students. A perspective by Amy Stimpfel from the New York University Rory Myers College of Nursing and Maya Jokic from the Jane and Robert Chizik School of Nursing, Houston, Texas. Americans owe roughly $1.65 trillion in educational loans, and a sharp rise in defaults has been observed since late 2025. Graduate students have been able to receive Grad Plus loans from the U.S. Department of Education for up to the full cost of attendance, including non-tuition costs. But due to concerns about high levels of student loan debt in the United States, Congress eliminated this program effective July 1st of this year in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. As part of this proposal, the Department of Education introduced the Reimagining and Improving Student Education, RISE, framework, in which graduate nursing students would be classified as graduate students rather than professional degree students. If finalized, borrowing for graduate nursing programs would be capped at half the level of medical and other professional programs. Nurses generally aren't high-risk borrowers, and advanced practice registered nurses, APRNs, have the lowest debt-to-earnings ratio and the highest projected job growth. These authors examined data on nursing salaries, and their analysis doesn't support reducing loan amounts. The new policy has the potential to constrain entry into graduate nursing programs and lead to a reduction in the number of APRNs and nursing faculty. To support the sustainability of the nursing workforce, policies must incorporate the voices of nurses and be based on the best available data. Nurse Scientists as Trusted Voices in Health Communication, a perspective by Paula Joseph from Rockefeller University, New York, and co-authors. Confidence in science and medicine has eroded substantially in recent years. According to the Pew Research Center, the proportion of the public expressing confidence in science fell from 67% in 2016 to 57% in 2023. Gallup polling similarly shows a marked decline in the proportion expressing trust in physicians, which has fallen by 14 percentage points since 2021. Nurses, however, have remained a notable exception. For 23 consecutive years, nurses have ranked as the most trusted professionals in the United States. In 2025, a total of 76% of Americans rated nurses as having high or very high levels of honesty and ethical standards, as compared with 54% for physicians. Nurse scientists are PhD-prepared nurses who design, conduct, and disseminate the findings of clinical and translational research. Nurse scientists have a rare combination of scientific knowledge, clinical insight, and relational trust. Their sustained credibility has been earned through ethical practice, evidence-based care, and commitment to patients. Despite the potential, nurse scientists remain largely absent from national health discussions. The Woodhull study revisited found that nurses were cited as sources in only 2% of health-related news stories and were never quoted in policy-related articles. Integrating nurse scientists into national health communication strategies is a pragmatic and necessary response to the growing challenge of restoring trust in health information. The dismantling of environmental protections, a grave threat to America's health. A perspective by Adam Gaffney from Cambridge Health Alliance, Massachusetts, and co-authors. During the first administration of President Donald Trump, nearly 100 environmental and occupational protections were rescinded. And the second Trump administration's actions have been even more aggressive, including 31 regulatory rollbacks. These Trump administration actions will accelerate climate change, pollute America's air and water, and cause more disease and premature death. Many administration proposals would weaken air pollution protections. Trump administration policies target power production, encouraging fossil fuel, particularly coal combustion, and discouraging clean energy production. Trump administration climate policies include withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, proposing to abandon the 2009 endangerment finding, and weakening rules requiring greenhouse gas monitoring. Additional Trump administration policies weaken water quality standards and reduce drinking water safety. Last April, the Trump administration fired most staff at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and the administration plans to eliminate EPA research, undermining science-based policymaking. Overall, Trump administration policies will result in dirtier skies, befouled waters, rising temperatures, more dangerous workplaces, and diminished quality of life, and the effects could be immense and long-lasting. Health professionals must call urgent attention to these actions, work with broad coalitions to halt them, and rebuild the agencies and protections. In our images in clinical medicine, a 27-year-old woman presented with a 2-week history of joint pain, fever, sore throat, and a non-pruritic rash that worsened during fever. Laboratory tests showed an elevated ESR and elevated C-reactive protein and ferritin levels. A diagnosis of adult-onset Still's disease was made. In another image, a 16-year-old girl presented with 1 month of ankle pain and 11 days of fever. Radiographs showed an ill-defined, radiolucent distal tibial lesion. On MRI, the lesion was hypointense and surrounded by a hyperintense sclerotic rim. A diagnosis of intraosseous abscess, also known as a Brody's abscess, from subacute osteomyelitis, was made. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.